That's great. I had the joy of seeing Steve just a few days ago out at the Shepherd's Conference, and I know they're blessed by way of your support and encouragement. So, well, listen, as we continue, let me just make this observation. I said sometimes today that we only use the word vocation to talk about our work. And in my last presentation, that's typically how I used it. I referenced our work for the most part. But to just help you again understand the bigger picture of what the Reformers taught, they looked at every role and responsibility that a man or woman has as a role or task that is assigned by God. If you were to look at Calvin in his writings on this, he would talk about the noble work of the cobbler. Okay, and not just the cobbler, though, but he would say that every man or woman fulfills multiple roles. And so maybe to help you think about this for a moment, men and women, what are all the roles that you currently occupy? Well, all of us were born into a family. That means we are sons and daughters. And the scriptures are clear that we have an obligation, don't we, to care for and to honor our parents. Some are living, some are not living. But we have a duty within our own family to care for our siblings, our parents, and so forth. All of us are either a brother or a sister. We may be an only child, but most of us have siblings. Most of us are nieces and nephews. All of us are citizens of the United States. All of us are residents within a certain neighborhood and might even have a homeowners association that makes it more official. All of us certainly are members of a church, okay? So when you step back and you ask the simple question, what are all of the roles the Lord has assigned me to? A parent would fall into that. Now you look at this issue of not just diversity of gifts and talents and abilities and so forth, but diversity of responsibilities and roles. And it'd be easy, ladies particularly, if you're at home with your kids, to be thinking, oh, this is all about using your work. You know, I'm at home. Well, biblically speaking, you have one of the most noble of all callings, and that is to disciple your children on a daily basis. It may not be a lot of fun when you're picking up after them or disciplining them for the same thing the 10th time in a row. Or you're just trying to get a meal on the table in the midst of the insanity. I have five kids, so I know the realities of home life. And yet, according to God, it is something that God has assigned and is a high calling for a woman as well. So even if you're at home, though, you might be members of the PTA, or if you're homeschooling, you're part of a homeschool association, or you might be part of some mom's group somewhere. Or it may be that you're the team mom for your kid's soccer team or basketball team. So you too need to stop and look at all the roles that the Lord has assigned to you in this season and ask again the simple question, is what can I do to be faithful? My wife always signs up to be the team mom for our kids' soccer teams. And I appreciate the way she goes about her commitment there to always be on top of things, communicate well, to serve. And she'll tell my own kids, she goes, this is an opportunity for me to serve and be a testimony to the unbelieving parents and to the coach. And so she's at home all the time, but she's recognizing that she's a part of fulfilling God's redemptive purposes and needs to shine as a bright light. And so that sometimes we just have to elevate the common, again, to understand that assigned by God, this is a noble calling. All right. I will continue to use mostly work examples. Let me just get set up here. Sorry. Okay. There we go. So, we're going to talk about how it is that we glorify God. And the first thing I need to remind you of is that our chief aim is to glorify God and enjoy Him forever. This is according to the Westminster Catechism, or according to Paul in 1 Corinthians 10:31, where he says, whatever you do, do all for the glory of God. Okay? All is not qualified, it means all. Everything that you approach in the course of your day to bring God glory by it. Well, I want to give you some examples from history. Let me start by asking a simple question. Which nation in the world is best known for producing the best watches? Okay, a little competition. Historically, it's been Switzerland. Japan's given them a run for their money. But Switzerland historically has been recognized as kind of the center of the watchmaking industry, historically. And when you think of a Swiss watch, you think of an excellent timepiece. But have you ever wondered why the Swiss were known for making excellent watches? Probably not. Well, I had the occasion a number of years ago to be in Geneva, Switzerland with a friend, and he drugged me to the Philippe Patak Watch Museum in Geneva. I said, why are we going to this watch museum? And he said, I want you to see something. And so we walked in, and Patak Philippe is known for really some of the world's finest craftsmanship in watches. Some of the most expensive watches that are made by this company. And it was fascinating, and they had a kind of three floors of this museum in their main offices in Geneva. And there was a docent, a lady who was giving us a tour, and we were seeing these phenomenal, rare, one-of-a-kind clocks, watches, mantelpieces that this company had produced over their history. And we got towards the end of the tour, and she took us to a special section. She says, I want to show you something that is very special. I want you to see some of the earliest watches that were ever made in Switzerland. And really, we credit our history to the makers of these watches. And she took us over to a case and showed us one particular example. And she said, this is a French Huguenot watch. And she began to explain that the Swiss watchmaking industry really owes its commitment to excellence and standard to the French Huguenots. And I thought, this is interesting. I knew enough about Reformation history to know that the French Huguenots were Protestants who, under the Edict of Fontainebleau, under Louis the 19th, I'm going to have to work on this, advancing the slide, okay. They were persecuted under this edict because Catholicism was reinstated as a state religion in France. And so the Protestants were being martyred. And there was a large group of them, over 500 of them, who fled France for Switzerland. And they went to be a part of the ministry of John Calvin, who was preaching in Geneva, Switzerland. And as they left their family, their industries, their homes, everything behind to flee this persecution, they found themselves unemployed in the city of Geneva. But they were sitting under the teaching of Calvin. So here were men who, if you will, had lost their jobs. And they had to create an entire new industry for themselves. And one of the industries that they took on was watchmaking. But they sat under John Calvin's teaching that was emphasizing the very principles we're talking about this morning, is pursue your work for the glory of God, to do it with excellence, to do it on behalf of your neighbor, and not just seek your own. That meant that they brought their best skills and talents to the design of watches. Here's an example from history of Christians who sought to glorify God in their work, and as a result became industry leaders. And this is a rarely known story. You don't see this marketed in all the glossy ads today in watch magazines. But this is true in many, many industries. For a number of years, I was involved in an initiative to try to start a nursing program at the Master's College. And the first thing I did is I went back and I studied the historic influences on the healthcare industry, and particularly nursing, and found that it was Christians who were at the forefront in the development of the healthcare industry, even in the ancient world, but leading up into Western civilization, the modern world, and particularly the field of nursing. And it was a delight to read the testimonies of these women who saw that the way that they provided care, loving care, to patients or to those in hospitals, or frankly, someone like Florence Nightingale in the battlefield, was an expression of Christian love. And because of their understanding of the dignity of man as made in the image of God, they deserve the best care. And so their compassion, their mercy, their love motivated them to provide the best care in the battlefield. That's the foundation, really, of the modern nursing movement. There are so many stories like this that today's Christians need to unearth. Because today we're made to feel as though we're the enemy. We're made to feel apologetic for standing on our morals and our ethics in the workplace. And sadly, our world has rejected its own historic influences. We certainly are seeing that in civil government and a number of other areas as well today. So be encouraged to know that there's some great examples from history. Now, maybe your love is for music, and most of us would recognize George F. Handel as a composer of The Messiah, in my opinion, one of the greatest pieces of music from a gospel perspective. If you want to see the articulation of the glory of who Christ is and what he did on behalf of man in fulfillment of Old Testament prophecies of a coming Messiah and the future resurrection, Handel captures that brilliantly in The Messiah, doesn't he? And we sing that typically at Christmas every year, maybe a portion of it at Easter. We hear a cantata of something of this. But I didn't really know the story of George F. Handel. So I want to tell you the story. I, as you know, have three adopted children. And so I was very curious to study the history of Christians in the area of orphan care, orphanages, and things like this. And I had the occasion, after visiting one of our schools, to stop in London for a few days. And I had a buddy there who told me, here's some key religious sites to visit. But he omitted one site, and it was the grounds of the Foundling Hospital, which was the very first orphanage that was ever constructed in Great Britain. And so I found my way to the property, which is still in downtown London. And the original buildings are no longer there, but the property is now a park. And the original gates and fences are still around this park property. It's a park that's dedicated to children. You can't go to the park unless children are with you. And so this is kind of in honor of their history. But adjacent to the park property was a museum. And I decided to go in and just to read the exhibits about the founding of this first orphanage in Britain. And I found that there were believers involved and so forth. And after I was done looking at the exhibits, I started to leave, and the docent behind the front counter said, "Did you get up to the third floor?" And I said, "No, I didn't get all the way up to the third floor." She goes, "You cannot leave without going up to the third floor." And I said, "Well, what's up there?" She goes, "I'm not going to tell you. You just go up." I said, "All right." So I wandered up to the third floor, and to my surprise, I walked into one of the most exquisite exhibits dedicated to George F. Handel and the Messiah. I said, "Where in the world do these two things come together, the Messiah and the Foundling Hospital?" Well, George F. Handel, leaving Germany, came to London and was working on the English composition of the Messiah. The Foundling Hospital that had just been established to care for the vast number of orphans and street children. If you want to go back and actually think about images that you might read in Dickens stories, imagine those realities at this time, and would only continue to develop into the period of industrialization. But you had a lot of poverty, a lot of orphan children on the streets of London. And so the Foundling Hospital was focused on taking these children in and providing health care for them, education, and so forth. But they needed a way to support their efforts, like all nonprofits. They had to raise money. So their strategy was to approach some of the great artists who lived in London and invite them to display their canvases on the walls of the orphanage. And then they would charge a fee for people to come and view the exhibits. And from those fees, they would raise enough money to provide for these orphans. Well, Handel heard about the Foundling Hospital, and he discovered that one of the ambitions of the leaders was to provide a chapel where the children could be taught from the scriptures. And they approached him, and he said, "You know, what I have to offer is this new composition called The Messiah." He said, "I would be very glad to come and perform the first performance of The Messiah in English to raise money for a chapel for the Foundling Hospital." So Handel did just that, and he conducted that first presentation of the Messiah in English there on behalf of the Foundling Hospital. It was so successful that he repeated this presentation for 16 years, I believe, coming and conducting it himself. And as a result, the proceeds that came in not only built the chapel, but continued to support the work of this orphanage. And I thought, here's a wonderful example of a Christian who's asking a simple question: where's there a need, and what do I have to steward, and how can I take what I'm good at, what the Lord made me good at, to actually share that in a way that advances his purposes in the lives of these children. I can't think of too many better examples than that, by way of the questions we should ask ourselves. Where's the need, what do I have to offer, and how can I use it in a way that honors the Lord? Just to kind of read this a little bit, this is a quote from Handel. Having generously and charitably offered a performance of vocal and instrumental music to be held at this hospital, and that the money arising therefrom should be applied to finishing the chapel of the hospital. That's in his own hand. This was his motivation to serve. In May of 1749, Handel conducted his first concert in the chapel itself. The sellout performance was attended by the Prince and Princess of Wales and raised more than £350 for the Foundling Hospital. Handel's specially composed piece, Blessed Are They That Considereth the Poor and Needy, soon became known as the Foundling Hospital Anthem. After his generous musical contribution to the Foundling Hospital, Handel soon became a governor of the institution. Messiah, which had not been well received on its first performance in 1743, became an annual event. Despite eventually being unable to conduct due to illness, Handel attended every performance until his death in 1759. It's fun, isn't it? A few years ago, I was down in the bookstore at our church, and I'm always looking for new books on missions. And I saw one that I thought had a pretty ambitious title. It was entitled Father of Faith Missions, The Life and Times of Anthony Norris Groves. At that point, I had had the pleasure of teaching missions at the college for probably about 15, 16 years. And one of the classes I taught was History of Missions. And I have to confess to you, I never had heard of Anthony Norris Groves. And I thought, and he's the father of faith missions. How did I miss this story? I really failed in my duty here. So I bought the book, took it home and read it, and just found it to be one of the most impactful biographies I've ever read. Let me tell you about Anthony Norris Groves. He was a dentist who lived in Great Britain. And he was part of a Bible study that was serious about knowing the scriptures and applying them to life. In this Bible study, he became convicted about the attitude that most people in England at that time had about wealth and money. And let's go back, maybe, ladies, if you're Jane Austen fans, and husbands, if you have loved your wife enough to sit through a showing of a number of those movies, if not read the books. You'll find a common theme in Jane Austen's writings that at that time, British society, you had to marry, right? You had to marry into wealth for what reason? To provide for you and for your family. There was no social welfare system. There was no retirement plans. And so if you didn't marry into money, then you were vulnerable. You were possibly going to find yourself destitute, okay? And so if you think of those stories and the narratives in her books, you see that very clearly. This was the culture and the society that Anthony Norris Groves lived in as well. And he says what was happening in the church is people became so focused on accumulating an inheritance to pass it on to their children, okay, that what was happening was it was stunting their faith. Because their focus was on hoarding financial resources so that they could take care of themselves. And not that financial planning is wrong and saving and any of that, but he was talking about a spiritual condition that he saw generationally, particularly with one generation that inherited money from their parents, and they tried to hoard that. And by the third generation, the idea of actually depending on the Lord, trusting the Lord, demonstrating faith in your own life for God's provision had really been stunted within the church. So led him on a quest to go back and study the scriptures as to the biblical principles for managing wealth and money. And as a result, he issued a tract or a pamphlet that he had titled Christian Devotedness. When I read the book, the tract isn't included in the book. I had to go online and I found an original copy somebody had scanned in, and I read it, and it's very biblical, and I would recommend it to you. As a matter of fact, it's been reissued recently, and you can buy it for about $2.50 on Amazon. And if you've read anything like Randy Alcorn's The Treasure Principle, okay, it's in that vein. So you'd find it very very helpful to think about your own view of money. But what Norris did is he says, this needs to be a corrective to the attitude within the church. And biblically speaking, we're to take our financial resources, and after we provide for our family, we are to invest our resources in gospel ministry, those things that advance the work of the church and the gospel. Well, this was not a popular tract at first, but eventually it really picked up steam and became read by many, many throughout Britain. What Norris was calling people to was to trust the Lord to provide for your needs, not living foolishly, but living generously. And to use whatever the Lord has entrusted to you to share with others, to meet needs, and certainly to invest in gospel work. That meant that somebody had to live by faith, not just hoard all their possessions and depend on themselves to provide, but expect that God would provide if they were faithful by way of generosity. This was radical thinking at that time in the church. One of the people who was most impacted by his writing and his teaching and was a member of that Bible study was his brother-in-law. Now here's a name that you'll recognize. It's the name George Mueller. Now many of you have read George Mueller's autobiography, and what is his strong emphasis? Yes, he loved orphans and he built these wonderful facilities to care for them, but the entire premise of his orphanages was to put on display God, that a person who lived by faith, who extended themselves to meet the needs of others, could trust that God would provide. And so he's a man of great prayer. Well, it was Anthony Norris Groves who basically discipled George Mueller or his brother-in-law in those biblical principles. And so Groves eventually decided that he needed to go to the mission field. And what did he have to offer? He was a dentist by trade. So he assembled a team around him, another medical doctor, a man who could preach and so forth. And he actually went from Great Britain up to St. Petersburg, or Leningrad, in Russia, picked up some other team members, and they traversed all the way across the continent. And he and his missionary team became the first evangelical missionaries to what's today modern-day Baghdad in Iraq. It's a fascinating biography. To trace this journey. Along the way, he would encounter brethren missionaries and so forth. Describes his ministry in Iraq, and then eventually he and his sons started missions work in India with business enterprises. So it's a really amazing biography to read. But if you look at the cover there, you see it's a tree, and there's a whole bunch of circles there. Well, you can't read the names, but the names on there are names such as Hudson Taylor, C.T. Studd, Amy Carmichael, Jim Elliot, and so forth. This is the pantheon of great missionaries, right, that we've all read their biographies and look up to. Interesting enough, every one of them was influenced by the tract Christian Devotedness in their view of missions that led them to just give their life away and trust the Lord to provide, but they were going to commit themselves to advancing the gospel. Of course, they did that in China, in India, and in many other places. So I'm convinced that we can credit Anthony Norris Groves as the father of faith missions after reading his biography. But here's a guy, if you will say, who is just a dentist. More than that, he was biblical in his convictions. And his convictions led him to take his dentist chair and his biblical training and to go and to try to win people for Jesus Christ. And so he serves as a wonderful example, I think, of those of us who go into some of these areas of vocational missions, that we can use the skills that we have. bring it home a little bit more closer to home by way of an example here in business. Some of you, of course, would recognize, if not all of us, Milton S. Hershey, the founder of the Hershey chocolate industry. Milton Hershey is a great story of a committed Christian who decided that he was going to approach his industry very clearly based on biblical principles. Now, at this time of industrialization, to work in a factory was a very dangerous thing. If you worked in a factory, the hours were long, the health conditions were poor, the literal threat to your life by way of the large equipment and so forth was a very large reality for people. And Milton Hershey looked at this approach to making chocolate and the factories that he created, and he actually said, you know, if I'm a Christian, I'm called to glorify God, that means I have to think about every aspect of my business and make sure that it aligns with biblical convictions and biblical principles. And so he understood that if God had entrusted to him a workforce, that it was his duty to care for them from a heart of Christian love. And so he was a real reformer with regard to factory policies and the model that he set up in what became Hersheytown, Pennsylvania. Has anybody been there to the factory? Okay, so you can appreciate this. Hershey said, instead of trying to exploit my workers to get the maximum amount of labor, to create the maximum amount of yield, so that I can have the maximum amount of revenue that I then hoard, okay, and put back into my own bank account, he says, I need to take portions of our profit and reinvest it back into my workers. One of the things that he did was not only create safe work conditions in his factories, but he also created housing, affordable housing, safe housing, quality housing. That was how Hersheytown was actually constructed, was taking the profits out of the business and providing good housing, planned community housing for his workers. In these communities, he also provided health care clinics, okay, to make sure their needs were met. He provided educational opportunities for their children. As a matter of fact, he started an orphanage for boys, young boys, that included a school. And so here's a man who didn't live for his own sake and for his own benefit, but he understood, if I'm skilled at this industry and I've got this family recipe in chocolate, then I need to go about my work in a way that will really demonstrate the love of God and the care and the dignity and respect for my workers. And Hershey really had a profound effect in the American landscape with regard to industrialization, because what he proved was that approach could be profitable. I have a website up there. It's called the Daniels Ethics Institute, and if you go there today, you'll read an article that those values are still embedded within the Hershey Company, to the extent of even where cocoa beans are harvested around the world, there are clear policies in place for just labor laws and just treatment of those field workers, even in developing countries, where their laws may not protect them, okay, but the company's values are going to make sure that those workers in the field are treated with dignity and with respect. Okay? This is an example of somebody who approaches their work as a Christian asking a different set of questions. You know, what's the minimum amount I can do to just get through the job? Okay, or how is it that I can just make as much money as I can from this job to meet my own needs? And I think this is a great example, and it's a challenge to business owners, large and small. Are you bringing your Christian values into the workplace? Now, if you own a company, you have a chance to really do something, I think, that's exciting but radical, is to impose these kinds of policies, making sure that, if you can, the best benefits are afforded to them. And in addition to that, you're developing a personal relationship with them and caring for them. So go and read the biography of Milton Hershey as an example. Sorry, I missed it. There he is. Take a look at him. The second, or the next example I want to refer to is JCPenney. Now, we all know about the Penney's department stores, right? You may or may not know the history of JCPenney. JCPenney founded his first shop on the principle of doing good unto others, okay? Kind of the golden rule was his idea. And what that led him to consider by way of values was, look, if we're going to create a product, we want to make sure it's affordable and it's a quality product. If people are going to pay money for a product, it should last. It should be durable. It should be something that's worth what they pay. Now, this is contrary to a lot of industries in our world today who try to produce the cheapest product at the highest cost and have little concern for the quality of the product, okay? And they focus more of their energies on marketing an inferior product to try to persuade and convince people that it's worth what they're being charged for. Penney rejected all that. He's a good businessman. He said, listen, I'm just going to have a business based on the principle of affordability and durability. Well, by the time of the Great Depression, Penney lost everything, including his first stores. And at this point, he made a lot of money, and though he lost it, he lived in New York City. And one day he was walking down the streets of New York City and passed a line that wrapped around the New York City rescue mission. Now go back to the images of the Depression and these soup lines. Okay, that's what he observed. And he saw hardworking men who could not find a job. And he recognized that the work of the rescue mission was a good work. And so he approached the people who worked at the rescue mission. And in his engagement with them, he affirmed what they were doing. But he also heard the gospel presented. And though he based his life on the golden rule, he really wasn't saved. And JCPenney came to faith in Christ in this period of his life. Well, following the Depression, or coming out of the Depression, he got enough capital to invest in relaunching his business. And that's the modern JCPenney's company that we know today. But again, he took those same values of durability, affordability, and so forth, and made those a hallmark of his company. What you may not know is that JCPenney continued to invest in the ministry of the New York Rescue Mission, and he became one of the board of trustees there. Now, at this point, JCPenney had a really beautiful home in New York City. A very valuable piece of property. And when he died, he donated his home in New York to the New York City Rescue Mission so that they could continue their ministry. Now, I don't know anything about them today and what they teach or preach, but here's a man who came to faith in Christ, who tried to approach his business, again, with same kinds of ethics and morals that we as Christians would have. But more than that, he looked at how to take his profit and reinvest it in gospel ministry. Now, later in Penney's life, before he died, he got more influenced by liberal theology that became very common at that time, and writings of men like Norman Vincent Peale and so forth. But nonetheless, we saw in a particular period of his life his commitment to live out his faith and the use of his resources. So, let's see who I've got up for you. There we are. Others of you would recognize R.J. Letourneau. R.J. Letourneau really developed some of the largest earth-moving equipment that was used to build bridges and dams and things like this around the world. I'll just read this statement. R.J. Letourneau is perhaps the most inspiring Christian inventor, businessman, and entrepreneur the world has ever seen. He was a sixth grade dropout. Okay, so there's hope for all of us. Robert Gilmore Letourneau went on to become the leading earth-moving machinery manufacturer of his day with plants on four continents, more than 300 patents to his name, and major contributions to road construction and heavy equipment that forever changed the world. Most importantly, his contribution to the advancement of the gospel ranks him among the greatest of Christian businessmen of all time. Here's what he was famous for. He was famous for living on 10% of his income and giving 90% to the spread of the gospel. Letourneau exemplified what a Christian businessman should be. Now, it's not to say that all of you can afford to live on 10% of your income, probably very few of you. But here was a man, 10% of his income was plenty. And he recognized that. And he lived simply, and he said, if God's going to bless me, then I have to be a good steward of these financial assets. And what can I do? And of course, one of the things they did was founded Laterno University, which is a Christian engineering school, and really an alternative to the land-grant institutions that I referred to earlier. So again, another great example for us of somebody who approached their work with excellence. In this case, he was one of the earlier multinational firms or companies, and he found himself in South America. Well, it says here four continents, but I'm more familiar with his work in South America, where he brought a lot of infrastructure to developing countries and using his equipment. Extremely generous. So some really fun examples for us to take into consideration this morning. So what is God's mission for us? Again, as we studied last year, in Acts chapter 1:8, building on the Great Commission, we are called to be witnesses to the uttermost parts of the earth. Or as Paul says in 2 Corinthians chapter 5, we are ambassadors for Christ as though God were pleading through us. Do you view yourself as an ambassador for the gospel? Well, you are. Matthew 28, of course, in Christ's commission, instructs us there to go and make disciples of all nations, okay? And of course, engaging them in the discipling ministry of teaching them the scriptures, and which is the primary work of the church. I said earlier that our mission is key to shining as a bright light, just as Christ said in the Sermon on the Mount in Matthew chapter 5. I'm not keeping up, I apologize. We'll go this way. One of my favorite texts that illustrates this is found in Philippians chapter 2. Now, we're familiar with Philippians chapter 2, what's termed the kenosis passage, looking earlier at the example of Christ, right, who humbled himself, took on the form of a man, even to the point of giving his life on a cross. And then we're called to be like-minded with Christ and dwelling together in a spirit of unity and humility, right, and serve one another. So if we're called to follow the example of Christ, then we need to imitate Christ in our attitudes, our actions, and our love for one another. Well, if you keep reading in the text, you come down to verses 15 and 16. And Paul says this, we're to live this way so that we will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent, children of God, above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation, among whom you appear as lights in the world, holding fast the word of life. Here's the same principle of being a light. It's not Christ here, it's Paul teaching the same principle. And he's saying, if you follow the example of Christ and live a life of humility and a willingness to serve others, then you're going to prove yourself to be blameless and innocent. And I love this, children of God. Who are you imitating as you live this way? You're a reflection of the character of God as you go about your work and about your roles in this fashion. And you live a life that's above reproach. Where? In the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. Listen, if any words describe the world we live in today, it's this phrase from Philippians chapter 2. We live in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation. But if we live lives of imitation, meaning of Christ, and we identify with God as our Father, then we have this wonderful privilege wherever God sets us to shine as a bright light. Okay, again, removing the shadows and guiding people to the truth. Tomorrow I'll be preaching out of the book of Titus, and Titus is very explicit on this theme. It's talking about the way that we live in this world and practice our good deeds before men. In chapter 2, verses 11 and 14, Paul writes, "For the grace of God has appeared for the salvation of all men, training us to renounce irreligion and worldly passions and to live sober, upright, and godly lives in this world, awaiting our blessed hope, the appearing of the glory of our great God and Savior Jesus Christ, who gave himself for us to redeem us from all iniquity and to purify for himself a people of his own who are zealous for good deeds." These are not tasks that we pursue to try to earn or merit God's favor. Ephesians 2, 8 and 9 is very clear, right? If we are saved, then we bear fruit. These are the good deeds of loving Christian actions in obedience to the scriptures and a life of integrity that's in accord with the ethics of Christ's kingdom. These are the good deeds. Bottom line, we live differently than the world. That's it. when you go to your cubicle tomorrow, or your office, or you take your kids to the playground down the road, the way you're going to go about your work and your relationships needs to be, it has to be, completely different from how the world goes about their work and their relationships. And you've got to understand how to bring biblical principles, biblical ethics into play in those practices. And if you do that, surrounded by people who are lost and blind and wandering and trying to find meaning in life and what's the purpose of life and is there a God and all these eternal questions, they look at you and they see something radically different about your life. Excuse me. And they're drawn, okay, through the work of the Holy Spirit in their life to question, why are you different? Who is the God that you know? Okay, what's governing your approach to life? And those become occasions for us to share Christ with them. Now, going back in a historical perspective so you appreciate this more fully, we need to look at the tradition of the Anabaptists. Thanks. Just getting over a cold. Thank you. Okay, the Anabaptists, or known as the Radical Reformers, and here's the deal with them. If you look at the classic reformers who corrected the soteriology of the church and taught on justification, right, and got the gospel right, they still upheld infant baptism, okay? And one of the dangers of infant baptism is it was key to the concept of Christendom, which meant that for someone to be identified with Christendom or the kingdom of God, they needed to be baptized and become citizens of that. That's the history of infant baptism. And so the reformers, some of them continued to uphold that teaching. The Anabaptists rejected that and taught believers' baptism, which meant that when you come to faith in Christ, you are baptized because it's an illustration of what happens to you spiritually. You died to yourself, you're buried with Christ, you're raised in newness of life. And therefore, the church, to be a true church, needed to be comprised of people who are genuinely saved, not people who are just baptized as infants. And so the Anabaptists really offer us a robust teaching on the issue of not only soteriology, but also on ecclesiology or the doctrine of the church. And it was from the Anabaptists that we derived the strongest understanding of the concept of lordship. So John R. Martin, in his book, Ventures in Discipleship, says that the Anabaptists used the German term Nachfolge Christi, or means following Christ or discipleship, which was central to their understanding of the Christian life and to their theology. We talk about discipleship all the time, right? And we have different ideas of how to do that, study a book, the relationship one-on-one, these kinds of ideas. But the way they talked about discipleship, they talked about with a capital D, being a disciple of Christ. It meant that you surrendered your entire life to Christ. You brought everything under his authority. Harold Bender explains it this way. In essence, the discipleship which the Anabaptists proclaimed was simply the bringing of the whole life under the lordship of Christ, and the transformation of this life, both personal and social, after his image. From this point of view, they subjected not only the church, but the whole social and cultural order to criticism. Okay, so what he's saying here is they just didn't look at life within the church to make sure that everyone was living according to biblical principles. They stepped back and looked at their entire life and asked, am I living according to biblical principles in every precinct of life? The way I manage my money, the way I approach my education, the way I raise my children, all these things, okay? They brought everything under the authority of Christ. And here's what they did. They rejected what they found to be contrary to Christ and attempted to put into actual practice his teachings as they understood them, both ethically and sociologically. Now, I'm not here referring to the idea of redeeming society and culture and those kinds of ideas. I'm talking about the very practical way you approach your life, okay, and how you think. For instance, you're going to vote in an election coming up, okay? Not many of us are happy with the options, okay? We have to approach the election, though, because it's a God-assigned role. We're citizens. We can't neglect our responsibility. So therefore, I have to think about the election how do I cast my vote in a way that's consistent with biblical principles as best as I can? Now, we're electing unbelievers, possibly. We'll see how it all plays out. Okay, so it's not to say that you can only vote for a believer, but you need to approach your values, if it's the values of a candidate or the values of a Republican or Democratic Party or wherever you align yourself with, have you evaluated what their platform is and how closely that aligns with biblical principles and priorities? Okay. Do you have that kind of discernment? And I'm just using the election as one example. It might be other areas of civic responsibility. It might be where you purchase certain products. And if you knowingly are buying products from a company or a firm that exploits people so that they can give you the cheapest price, you benefit from that at the expense of somebody else. So you can't know all those things, and you want to be a good steward and find the best prices and things like that. But when you become aware of sinful exploitation that you're enabling, you have a duty and responsibility to think through your choices in that regard. That's what the Anabaptists taught. You have to look at everything you're committed to in life, every responsibility, and ask, to the best of your ability, can I approach it in a biblical fashion? I'm sorry, didn't give that one to you either. So, this raises the stakes for us, okay? And that means what I do in my work has got to be purposeful in finding every occasion to try to approach it in a way that honors the Lord in my decisions and my priorities and things like this, okay? All right, I want to just share a couple examples with you, and then we'll take a break. Kind of make it real practical for you for a moment. I'll start with a story of a student that came to me one day, and she said, her name was Rebecca. And Rebecca said, I have a really full schedule. I'm a music major here at the college. That means I practice a lot of hours. And she said, but it's on my heart to get off campus and to share the gospel at least once a week. I want to make that commitment and be accountable to that. It's okay. She says, but I don't know where to go and I don't know what to do. It's okay. I said, well, Rebecca, let me ask you a couple things. What kind of people do you love? If you could spend a day with a kind of person or a group of people or a demographic of people, what kinds of people would you really want to spend the day with? She said, I really enjoy elderly people. I said, okay, that's great. I said, I know this about you, Rebecca. You're not just a music major, but you're a piano performance major. And she played the piano in her chapels. It was excellent. And I said, you love piano, don't you? And she said, yeah, I love the piano. And I said, you're good at it. And she kind of put her head down. And I said, well, I know you're good at it, so I'll just affirm that. I said, Rebecca, let's ask this question. If God gave you the skill to play the piano and you love to do that, and you have a heart for elderly people, where could those two things align as an opportunity to share the gospel? And she's like, I don't know. I never thought about that. See, what Rebecca was thinking is, I need to go sign up for a program where I go door-to-door, pass out tracts, or I do these other kinds of things. And I said, let me suggest something to you. If you go down the road here, there's a retirement home. Just walk in and go up to the director and ask if you could volunteer to come in 1 hour a week. She had 1 hour on Friday afternoons. Where you could come and just play the piano in their multi-purpose room. She's like, you can do that? I said, yeah, give it a shot. So she came running up to me a few days later. She goes, you're not going to believe what happened. I said, well, what happened? She said, well, I went to the retirement home. I went up to the front desk. I introduced myself, said I'm a student at the college, and I'm a piano performance major, and I just would love to come encourage some of your people here in the home, and I'd be willing to come if you'd let me. Once a week just to play the piano. She said, before I was even done speaking, the director grabbed my hand and took me down the hall to their multi-purpose room and set me at the piano. And she said, you're here. It's all yours. Let's play. Let's do this. And Rebecca said, I was shocked. I thought I was going to maybe, you know, have to beg for permission to come back next week or a couple weeks from that. So she said, I didn't come prepared, so I just sat down. And again, she was very good and accomplished. And she said, I just thought, well, I'll play a medley of hymns. That's what I knew. So she just started playing these hymns. And she said, it didn't take long, but I began to hear the shuffle the walkers and the wheelchairs. And I looked up and I realized I was beginning to have an audience. And she said, as I began to play, I just would stop in between the songs and I would share a little bit of my testimony and what the songs meant and who Christ was. My friends, it can be that simple. We make gospel ministry so difficult sometimes because we have these images and ideas of all these programs that we have to be involved in. But here was Rebecca, true just like the examples we talked about, somebody just like Handel who said, what do I have? Where is there a need? And where can I connect the dots between those? I could tell you stories of men, one particular man who worked for IBM years ago, who became aware of a ministry in South Los Angeles, South Central, through World Impact. They had a Christian school there. It was a junior high and high school. And part of their desire was not only to give them a Christian education, but keep these kids out of the gangs and prepare them to go to college. And they had very limited resources. All the faculty or all the teachers were on missionary support. And they knew for these kids to excel in education and in their careers, they were going to have some computer training. So they decided to step out in faith and open up a computer lab at their Christian school. They did not have the money to go out and buy new computers or anything. But this gentleman who worked at IBM became aware of the need, and he realized that his company has charitable donation policies. And this is true of most industries. That they can take maybe the end of the year models they haven't sold, sometimes first year models as well, and donate them to community organizations. And so this gentleman was aware of that program at IBM, and so he approached his supervisor and said, hey, they need, I think at that time they needed 16 PCs. And, here's a supervisor, and of course he's motivated by self-interest and the reputation of the company, and that's why they have these policies in place. We can donate PCs to an inner city computer lab. Boy, this is great, you know. So this gentleman secured those PCs and ended up being more than 16, I believe, and provided for World Impact, at that time, a state-of-the-art computer lab. But he did just do that. He went on to say, listen, I want to get personally involved. So he grabbed some of his colleagues on their day off, and they went down. They set up the entire computer network, and they started going back and volunteering to actually mentor the kids and the teachers in the computer lab. And this computer lab became a place for those teachers at that school to have an inroad into the young lives of these kids and to share Christ with them. What many Christians don't recognize is that the companies and firms they work for have policies like this. And we reduce our investment in missions and evangelism and thinking it's either I go overseas or I write a check, both of which are good things. But there's a lot of assets and resources in our companies and industries that are available legally to share and to distribute to nonprofits and particularly faith-based ministries. It's just someone needs to be the bridge. Someone needs to stand in the gap. And if you're working for a company, it might be a bakery that is willing to donate the end of the day products that don't sell to a food bank or a rescue mission. I can think of really hundreds of examples. And we've got to get Christians to begin to think this way, to unleash the resources that are available at their fingertips. But going back to where we started, if you've got this dichotomy view, oh, this is ministry over here, and then over here I just do my job, you're not looking for those connections, you're not looking for those opportunities. But I'll never forget the look in Rebecca's eyes. In essence, the day I gave her permission to connect her passion with the kingdom of God, okay, was a day that I still see her at church, and she still talks about that. She said, you just opened up an entire new platform for me. She goes, now I'm at home with my kids, but I'm teaching piano in my home, and I'm trying to think about how to use that as an opportunity to reach my neighbors. See, she's thinking like a person who's brought everything under the lordship of Christ. And that's why I say it gets really exciting when you begin to understand this and think this way. All right, I've gone long. You've been patient. So we're going to take a break, if that's okay. About a 15-minute break, though we're running a little bit late. And we'll come back, and then I'll give you a few more principles on how to see biblical ethics in the workplace and how to navigate that. Thank you.